natural law is pretty consistent across cultures. People pretty much all believe that we should all tell the truth, we should all keep our promises. But you know what is also true is that not every worldview believes in forgiveness. And I've met a lot of people who do not believe in forgiveness. And those people tend to be really sad and angry people. If I can make you laugh, that means I have said something that you also agree with and understand. I mean, everybody experienced childhood trauma. If you don't think you did, you definitely need therapy, because you did too. Because just being alive is often quite traumatic.
I'm excited to welcome a very special guest today. Award-winning author, professor, husband, father, drummer, and one of the funniest and most insightful voices on the page, Harrison Scott Key. Welcome to the Carti Hopecast, where we explore stories that shape us, journeys of resilience, hope, and perseverance. We seek the lessons that emerge when we face the unexpected and find strength in the struggle. On the Hopecast, we often talk to people whose lives have been turned upside down by a crisis or unexpected change, and what it looks like to find meaning, hope, and sometimes even humor in the middle of it. Today's guest has done all three in some of the most brilliant ways. Harrison Scott Key, welcome to the Hopecast.
Well, you described me as brilliant, so just keep going, man. That was great. Make it long.
I'll do my best. Well, I should tell you, I'm a huge fan of your work. The clever, fearless fusion of raw human experience with comedy and How to Stay Married first completely drew me in, and then I immediately went and read The World's Largest Man, and then Congratulations, Who Are You Again? And it is hard to read your work and not feel like, that you know you, especially listening to you narrate your own books, which is something I want to hear a little bit more about. If somebody took a snapshot of your world right now, what would it look like?
Oh, yeah, I don't know, man. It's kind of, it's kind of a chaotic season right now. Many things can be true at once. I'll tell you one thing that's true. I have an amazing life. I have the life that a 20-year-old Harrison would have been shocked and surprised to find that he had. Or a 30-year-old Harrison, or honestly, a 45-year-old Harrison might be shocked. I have basically everything that I've ever dreamed about having, I have now. And I mean, I've got a beautiful family, three kids who are three teenagers. They are 15, 17, 19. And I really like all of my kids. I like hanging out with them. I find them interesting people that I would like to be friends with. They're funny and talented. My 15-year-old, and there are three girls, my 15-year-old thinks I'm the coolest, funniest person in the world, which is amazing to have a teenager that age who thinks you're cool. My 17-year-old sat in with my band last month for a couple of songs, which was so cool. She sang and played guitar with my band. I play drums.
Nice. Yeah.
My oldest is a sophomore at the University of Georgia, and we just had a great conversation yesterday about her classes. She's a philosophy major, and so she told me all about her classes and what she was excited about without prompting, which as a dad, I'm sure you can appreciate that a kid just volunteers information is really special. I really love my wife, and we're getting along better than we ever have, and just having a good time together. I have a great community. I get to ride my bike to work every day. Like, that's so cool that I live close enough to my office that I can do that. Live in a beautiful town, Savannah. I've got great friends, a great job at SCAD. So my life is great. I have a great life. I feel very fortunate with my life. But it's also kind of chaotic right now. We're in a season of transition with girls leaving the house, and we're getting older, and just sort of our roles in the family are changing. Mm-hmm. And you know, I've been at my job for 20 years now. And so that's kind of feels different. But that's exciting. That's not a bad thing. It's just, it definitely feels like there's some kind of change in the air. I'm not sure what that means. But that's a snapshot of my life right now. Also, my backyard floods every time it rains. And this has consumed my every waking moment to solve this problem. I am sadly not a civil engineer, but I've been on the phone with about 30 contractors trying to figure out what to do about it. I'm going to be really sad when I finally get it fixed because I'm going to need a new hobby. So that's making my life, like every time it rains, I go to the window like a dog and I'm like looking at the rain, and I have pumps in the yard, and it's, as you can see, it's, my wife is very excited for me to get this fixed. So I'll stop talking about pumps and water. Anyway, that's my life right now.
No, I appreciate that. I had my share of digging French drains growing up, but it was never, you know, by choice. I didn't want to do that.
I don't think anybody really wants to be digging French drains unless they're getting paid, but I can appreciate that. Yeah. You know what? I just decided, I've sent so many texts and emails with the phrase French drains that I just say drains now. I don't even say French drains. I just say, you know, drains. And like, I'm like, why am I? French drain is such a cool term, but I just say it so much now that I just say, can you, I had texted one contractor, I sent him a picture of my yard. I was like, can you please make this dry? That's all I said. I didn't, and he responded, maybe. And then with some, you know, dollar sign emojis. I'm like, yeah, man.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anything for a price.
Yeah.
Well, I want to rewind to 2016. When you won the Thurber Prize for American Humor for your first book, The World's Largest Man, just so everybody understands, past finalists for this award, when I actually looked this up, include comedians like Jon Stewart, David Letterman, Trevor Noah, and Bob Newhart. And I think all of them, I think they were finalists. I don't think they actually won it.
Trevor Noah won. He won his year.
Did Trevor Noah win? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's, you know, you're in good company. But The World's Largest Man is a story about your relationship with your father, which you somehow made both hilarious and touching. What drew you to tell that story first and in such a complex and comedic tone?
Yeah, I knew I wanted it to be funny. But really the challenge for me, I don't know about other authors, but I knew I wanted to write a book, and I knew that I had stuff in me to get out. I didn't quite know what it was in there. And this is a total misconception that many people have about writing, that when you know, there are some books that you're like, hey, I want to write a book. Like, you know, I don't know, you've been a CEO for 20 years and you're like, hey, I should write a book about leadership. Like, that some books come about like that, where you have the idea and then you write the book. But in the sort of creative, literary, imaginative world of writing, it is not that clear. It's more like, I love books, and I think I feel like I could write one. I feel like I've got many stories in me. I don't know what they're about. I don't know what they're called. It's much more sort of groping in the dark when you're trying to write something imaginative, just like it would be if you're a painter or a musician. You don't really know where you're going. You know, I seriously doubt a musician's like, you know what, I'm going to make an album where I play nothing but the xylophone. Let's do it. It's more like you just discover what instruments, you know, all that. So I knew I had books in me, and I wrote tons of stories. I wrote stories about my family. I wrote stories that were total fictions. I wrote stories about my childhood, and I took some of the best ones. This was like, this is when I was maybe like 31, 32.
Okay.
I'd been trying to write a book for a few years, and I gave these stories to people I trusted who had some familiarity with literature, professors and friends who were writers. And I was like, tell me what you think. And they came back and they didn't say much positive about anything. You know, I wrote one story was like a story about a talking unicorn, which I thought was just the most brilliant, you know, experimental thing ever. And nobody even mentioned that story. But they would always say, some of these stories about your dad are really interesting. And that happened just enough where I was like, okay, I got to listen to these people. I did not want to write some sad sack memoir about my failed relationship with my father. That seemed like the most boring, trite, obvious thing. That, I mean, when men write memoirs, they're about their dads. When women write memoirs, they're about their moms. Men write about seeking their fathers out, pursuing their fathers. Fathers are elusive and difficult to know. Women tend to write about escaping their mothers and getting out of the house and getting away from that, and which is fascinating, but I didn't want any part of that. And then eventually I had a big handful of stories, and some were about my dad and some were about my wife and some were about my children. And I met my agent. She was not my agent yet. I met her at a conference. She liked one of my stories that she had read. We went out to lunch. This was at Ole Miss in Oxford, 2013. So I was 37 years old by this point. And we were sitting at lunch, and I was like, and she kind of had scanned over these stories, and I was like, what do you think? And she goes, well, this is definitely a book. And I was like, that's great news. What is it about? She goes, oh, this is about your dad. Don't you see it? Don't you see that your whole sort of reconciling with the South and what it means to be from the South and hunting and fishing and sports and manliness and all this, like that your dad is really like the somehow the villain, but also like the goal, the thing that you're seeking in the story. Yeah. And that's what a good agent or a good editor will do. They will help you to see clearly what you can't see. And when she said that, I was like, man, I guess I'm gonna have to write one of these dad books. And so I jumped into it, and my father was ill at the time. And as I was finishing the book, he died. So I did not know how the book was going to end. But when my father died, I was like, well, I think that's probably how this book ends, is my dad dying. And my sort of, you know, when a son experiences the loss of a father, anybody, but definitely a son, it brings out feelings you didn't know you had in you. Mm-hmm. A lot comes out. And the sort of, you asked about like this, like it wasn't just funny, but it was like kind of, it was profound and it was emotional. That came out because I was dealing with my father's death. And so the emotion was kind of unavoidable. And when I go back and look at it now, it's like, wow, that was in some ways what made the book so special, is that there was so much honesty and emotion about how much I had hated my father at one point and how I really did love him. There's so many men who feel that way about their dads. They hate him and they love him at the same time. So it was just a sort of perfect storm of emotion that led that book to being both somehow kind of ridiculously silly and like really deep at the same time.
Do you feel that writing that story first, going there first, actually built resilience in you, or the ability to go there, so to speak, again, and as you're processing things in the future and as you look back now at your other two works?
I don't really think I had a choice about that being first, in the sense that so many of the stories in The World's Largest Man were about my childhood and about, you know, so, you know, most, like if anybody's going to write a memoir, like look to things that happened to you before you were 12 years old, because that stuff, those stories just change you and stay with you, like stories from after that time don't. And so it just was a natural starting place. I'd always wanted to write a novel, and I still do want to write a novel, but those stories were the stories I told. Like if you and I went on a road trip and we were in the car for 20 hours together, I would probably have told some of those stories to you because they were just sort of kind of the myths of my childhood. Everybody's got stories like that. And that's good advice. If we have anybody out there who's a writer, like what stories do you tell around the fire pit when conversation gets quiet and you're with somebody you trust? Like what stories come out? And which ones do you tell over and over again? That's your own heart's way of telling you what stories matter most to you. You don't have to know why you keep telling those stories over and over again. You'll figure it out when you actually write them, start writing them down. But that's what happened to me.
You said you didn't want to write How to Stay Married. Just now kind of shift into your most recent book that you released. And yet it became your most vulnerable, revealing, and arguably most important work to date. What shifted in you that made you want to decide to write it anyway?
It was more of I didn't want to write it, but knew I had to. It was very hard. I mean, in some ways, I'm still dealing with the difficulty of writing that book. You know, I felt a lot of guilt in writing that book because I knew it would expose my family, especially my wife, that it would expose us to ridicule, that I would be ridiculed. I felt kind of preemptively, and this turned out to be true, that there were certain kinds of people out there in the world who were going to hate me for writing this book. I won't go into detail about what I think about those people or who they are, but anybody who's read the book or I knew there was a certain type of person who was not going to really think I should have written this book. I knew that my friends and strangers who were divorced might take offense at a book that's like, hey, you know, I'm not really conservative. I'm not really liberal. I'm not even really a centrist. I just really don't care about politics at all. I like the ideas that people, I like watching people fight about politics. I feel like that tells you something about us and about them. But I think a lot of people think of me as being more progressive because I have a PhD and I work at a university and I write books and I kind of fit the profile of somebody who's probably a liberal. And I knew that that book would shock and confuse some people because there's some very conservative moments in that book. I talk about the Bible. I talk about faith. I talk about church. I also talk about my doubts. I mean, it's the only book that's ever been, you know, a finalist for Book of the Year in Christianity Today that has the F-bomb like 20 times in this book, which is quite a feat. That Christianity Today gave me a good review and this book is absolutely vulgar. I mean, so I feel like that's a great professional accomplishment. Yeah. So I knew it would confuse people. I just knew it was going to be hard. And I'd already had two books come out and gone on book tours and interacted with the media and with fans, and I knew, and they had both been books about my life and my family. So I'd already exposed myself and my people a little bit, but this book was at a whole new level of vulnerability. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want that. I thought that's the last thing we need. Like, we're still healing from this. And shouldn't we just heal privately? And so part of me was like, yeah, don't write the book, man. Just don't do this. But the other part of me, the writer part of me, who's much more convincing than my conscience, the writer part of me said, dude, I think you have to tell this story. This is a really powerful story. And it was upsettingly easy to write that book. It was so therapeutic that working on the book did not feel like work at all. It felt like sitting with the wisest, most caring and funny therapist you can imagine. And it was so important for me to process that story and to give it to my wife and have her read it and process it and then write her own chapter for it. It was all so therapeutic. Actually, the worst part of writing that book is when it came out and I had to go, you know, to bookstores and book festivals and talk about it constantly. I didn't want to talk about my wife's affair anymore. That's why I wrote a book. So you can just read about it. I don't have to talk about it. But that's not how it works in publishing. So here I am on your podcast. I'm just kidding. It's been 2.5 years. I'm okay. I'm totally okay with talking about it now, but it was really hard when the book first came out to just, like, every interview was like rehashing the worst experience of my life. What was cool about the book, or what's cool about the book, is that the humor shows you, if anybody's been through this, if you've ever been through infidelity, comedy is such a balm when that happens to you. Like, You know, whenever I, and this still happens, when I meet somebody who is, I mean, we like to call it, it's the club that nobody wants to be in. Whenever I meet anybody who's been in something like this, we immediately go to jokes and go to absurdity, because the situation becomes very absurd very quickly when you are dealing with, you know, the fact that my wife fell in love with our neighbor and wanted to marry him. Like, it's already comic. It sounds like a comedy setup. It doesn't sound like a tragedy. And so writing the book in this way and kind of just being honest about the absurdity was so healing and felt so great. And was not, it was just a, it was a difficult experience. I knew it was going to be hard, but I knew I had to do it.
Thanks for joining us for part one of my conversation with Harrison Scott Key. Stay tuned for part two, coming soon on the Carti Hopecast.